Welcome to the Intelligence Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
The Defense Intelligence Agency operates a program called the Intelligence Community Centers of Academic Excellence. It's supposed to deepen the pool of diverse job applicants to the intelligence community, but the Government Accountability Office finds the program in serious need of a management snap-to. For the details, we turn to Brian Mazanek, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. Good to have you back.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Tom.
So this program actually goes back quite a number of years, but it has transferred to a new owner?
That's correct. Yeah, it's actually kind of going back to the future here. This program was created in response to language in the Intelligence Authorization Act back in 2004, and ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, initially managed the program for the first 6 years or so, and then it transitioned to the Defense Intelligence Agency up until now, and it's in the process of actually going back to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
But you found that as it goes back, it's not very well managed.
Yeah, we found that the Defense Intelligence Agency had not sufficiently planned or overseen the program during their time as the lead entity managing it, the effort. In particular, they had not implemented a number of key practices of sound planning, things such as developing results-oriented goals for the program and sort of what they want to achieve in a tangible way, identifying performance measures to gauge progress towards those goals, developing strategies to implement them, and evaluating external factors that could get in the way. They really fell short in all of those areas. And we do think that this is, as it transitions back, it's an opportunity to make some improvements in those areas. And we had 7 recommendations directed to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence as they take over the program to try to learn from DIA's experience and help strengthen the program going forward.
And let's back up for a moment. How does this program work? What is it supposed to do?
So this program is really unique. It's essentially a grant program to universities. It's a competitive process where universities apply and grants are awarded for a period of up to 5 years. They're typically 3 to 5 years where they get financial assistance to develop an intelligence-related program that's intended to help develop a candidate pool of prospective applicants to the community, particularly from diverse communities and universities that have a diverse population. So this means that they will develop curriculum that's related to intelligence at the university as part of this program. They'll have some type of foreign language program that's relevant to the intelligence community. They'll have an annual colloquium where they bring in speakers from the community, but really it's to help develop interest in working in the community and qualifications among an applicant pool that's diverse. And for the intelligence community, people are really one of their greatest resources. So diversity is critically important as the IC operates around the globe, and there's a need to have language skills and cultural awareness that this program can hopefully help bring into the community. So it's definitely a very important and unique program.
And it sounds like the DIA didn't set tangible or measurable goals for the program.
That's right. There was an overarching, and there has been for really the 15 years or so that this program's existed, there's been a consistent overarching mission statement, sort of purpose for the program, which I just spoke about a moment ago. But beyond that, they had not developed specific measurable goals, strategies, and some of those other key practices that I mentioned, which is definitely important. I think part of it, why they executed this way, was DIA really seemed to view their role as grant execution focused. So really at a tactical level, they were focused on the financial execution of these grants and sort of shepherding the process, but not that higher level management that was really necessary to ensure that the program was achieving its results.
Brian Mazanek is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at GAO. I'm Tom Temin.
From idea to battlefield, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping customers accelerate readiness, resilience, and strategic modernization. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear through our software factories and providing proven autonomy capabilities, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, we're developing practical answers for a complicated world. Visit leidos.com/defense to learn how.
We're speaking with Brian Mazanek, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office. And so measures like how many people were actually hired, for example, based on the grant that went to a particular school or university, they really weren't tracking?
That's right. There's a number of prospective measures that they could have been tracking consistently. They were collecting data on some of these, but it wasn't necessarily in a consistent way, and they weren't systematically evaluating. But things that they could be looking at were the number of participants in the ICCAE program, and we found some variability as we talked to some of the colleges and universities who are receiving these grants in terms of what they consider a participant. Is it someone who's enrolled in an actual degree or certificate program associated with this overarching effort, or is it someone who simply attends one or more courses that are affiliated with it? So there was some variability there, but once they, I think, clearly defined what they wanted to track, they could be tracking participation in the program, the number of students who get IC internships or conditional offers of employment, and even new hires, folks who make it through the IC onboarding process and the security clearance process and actually enter the community. So those are all the kinds of things that they could be tracking. And ODNI, in consultation with DIA, is looking now at developing those. So we're hopeful that they can learn from this experience over the last 15 years and really improve the program going forward.
And as they pushed money out the door, how effective were they at the oversight of the universities and colleges getting that money? Because those places can be black holes for grant money.
So we really, because of their lack of planning and oversight, we really can't answer that question as to whether or not the universities were judiciously using the resources and that the program was achieving the ultimate goals that it was intended to. That's something that, again, once they address these deficiencies we found, they may be able to better answer that going forward.
And how much money is involved, by the way, in these programs?
So since its inception in 2004, and really 2005 is when the grants first began to be awarded, there's been $69 million.
And you've made a number of recommendations not to DIA, but to the ODNI, I guess, as they take this program back. And any response, do they agree with you?
That's right, yeah. So ODNI did concur with all seven of our recommendations. They didn't provide specific details as to how they plan to implement them, so we will be following up with them over the next few months and years to see how they implement our recommendations. But we are hopeful, again, that this is an opportunity. Really, the timing was right for us to come look at this as it transitions, because we think our recommendations will help ODNI position itself to effectively manage the program.
Strikes me this is something that every agency program that's trying to get talent in, and that's pretty much every agency in the federal government, ought to take a look at this, because all you hear about is how tough it is to get talent into government agencies, and as agencies pursue every authority and opportunity they have to get people in, they really ought to run a program like this in a way that's effective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely a unique program that could have broad application in other contexts as well. And once, you know, ODNI, the transition is complete and they hopefully develop some of these key performance measures and collect more data, I think they'll be in a better position to help share lessons learned and inform other elements of the federal government that might want to have a similar program in place.
And have there been at least a few people actually hired and successful in the IC through the program?
So we don't have comprehensive data on that, as I mentioned. ODNI did report right at the point of the last transition when the program was moving in 2011 to DIA. They did sort of a capping report. We weren't able to independently corroborate their numbers, but at that time they reported that there had been 61 new hires into the IC from the program. That, again, that's at 2011, so about the halfway mark from its inception to where we are now. But we don't have any good data on what happened since then. I should say, too, just to be fair to the community, it is a difficult question because of the sensitivities of the intelligence community to really report, especially publicly through the universities, for some of the IC elements, sort of who transitions into the community ultimately.
In some cases, you might not be able to reveal their names.
Exactly, yeah. So that's a challenge that we definitely heard about and ODNI is working on as they go forward and managing the program.
Brian Mazanek is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the Government Accountability Office. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
We'll post this interview and a link to his report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Apple Podcasts or Podcast One. I'm Tom Temin.
From idea to battlefield, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping customers accelerate readiness, resilience, and strategic modernization. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear through our software factories and providing proven autonomy capabilities, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, we're developing practical answers for a complicated world. Visit leidos.com/defense to learn how.
The National Security Agency, like many federal agencies, is acutely aware of the cybersecurity threat, but it's not sure the general business world is, so it turned to Penn State University to develop an online cybersecurity course. Here with details, one of the three academics who wrote the course, law professor Ann Toomey McKenna. Ms. McKenna, good to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Tell us about this course, first of all. Did you develop it as part of something, was it a grant from NSA or a contract?
The NSA is part of broader initiatives of the Homeland Security to improve cybersecurity education across the U.S., issued a call for proposals. And Penn State, in multiple units at Penn State, collaborated together. So Penn State Law, our Applied Research Laboratory, our Information Sciences and Technology College, and Penn State Dickinson Law all worked together. In this case, we developed a law policy, cyber, you know, sort of a broad range proposal course. Several courses were proposed, and the NSA, out of the courses proposed, selected two. And one of those was the cyber operations, the law and policy course. And that was a collaboration with myself, my colleague, Admiral James Houck, who's the former Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy. And he really brought his national security expertise to bear on the course development. And one of our colleagues with the School of International Affairs, Scott Gardner, who assisted with the policy aspects of the class development.
And this course is intended for what types of people?
So that's the interesting thing of this and what is such a positive in how the NSA went about this. The NSA asked us to design a law course about cyber operations that could be taught to non-lawyers and really no requirement of any technical background or expertise. And so the intended audience could be undergrads, grads, or one, you know, group the NSA particularly cared about is the U.S. workforce. And so they wanted a course that could be designed to be taught as a whole, comprehensively, or modules, smaller units of the course could be taken and taught independently. So in a very unusual way we went about this is we created a course designed to be taught, you know, in whole or part, and designed to be taught by anyone who might be interested. So any executive branch, any U.S. agency, any business in the U.S. could take pieces of this and teach it to its staff, to its employees. Also, any college professor, any, you know, somebody who wants to introduce these concepts even in high school, any graduate program could use all of these materials to teach comprehensively an entire 40-hour, 3-credit course, or they could take bits and pieces to enhance their own curriculum development.
And is it free to people, or is there a charge for it?
Yeah, that's the other really positive thing about this. The course is, and all materials are free for download. The NSA operates this through Clark Center, which is operated through Towson University in Maryland. It's available online. You can simply type in Clark Center. You could type in, you know, principles of cyber operations. And there's multiple courses, not just this one particular course that we did in cyber operations and cyber law and policy. But, you know, this content is there. It's free. And it was very well designed, again, with that idea of you could comprehensively take and teach these materials, which is really a boon to any, you know, any college or university that wants to enhance its curriculum, but also for you know, employers. Employers could just say, hey, we want to have, you know, more awareness of our employees in this particular section. And because it was for non-lawyers, one piece of it that was really exciting and different was we got to step back and kind of teach the overview, a quick overview, like a crash course on how the U.S. legal system works and that separation of our federal and state courts and how the three branches of government work. We obviously are all hearing a lot about how the three branches of government work these days.
Or don't work.
Yeah, well, okay, agreed. But so that was, you know, it was a really different thing. You know, I've taught law for years. I know my colleagues, Admiral Houck and Professor Gardner, have all taught, you know, these graduate-level programs and law courses. So to really take a step back and say, hey, let's make sure everybody understands when we're engaged in cyber operations or we're considering cybersecurity, that we understand the legal framework in which we're operating. I think folks need to be aware when they're engaged in something that involves U.S. law. When are they engaged in something that could be considered, you know, a problem under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? When are we engaged in operations that implicate national security? And so that was, you know, kind of bringing that together is an unusual thing.
We're speaking with Anne Toomey McKenna. She's a law professor at Penn State University. And just briefly tell us about the course itself, what people get online. Is it lecture capture where you're listening to people that are videotaped? Or is it just text and you answer questions? How does it work? What's the user experience here?
Right. So for this particular course, and again, there are multiple courses on the Clark Center site that the NSA has paid professors across the country to develop. For this particular course, we prepared it with a detailed syllabus that's very lengthy, and then we prepared individual lessons that are PowerPoint-based. We use PowerPoint as the format, including with testing questions and discussion queries, because we thought that would be the most easily accessible across multiple educational platforms. So whether it was a college or university or simply an office place that wanted to engage in professional workforce education. And so the PowerPoints contain embedded content. In some cases, they contain embedded video. And again, they include questions and review, so that it's really a comprehensive package that anyone can just pick up either in whole or part and use. When you asked about how's the course, you know, how did we develop it? And I already talked a little bit about sort of that framework of making sure folks understand the U.S. legal system and how our courts work, how Congress works, and how presidents, the executive office works or is supposed to work. And then what we did, we started with that, but then we also did a crash course in technology. We took a section or a module of the course and really explained the fundamentals of communication platforms, explained the fundamentals of cellular technology and internet technology. Because again, we see that learning and education tends to be in these buckets, right? And there's the tech bucket and the national security bucket and the law bucket. And we wanted to bring those together in this class. So we start again with that overview of the U.S. legal system. And then we go into, you know, the cyber governance through the three branches of government, and then we go through the technology, and then how we, you know, kind of build from explaining cyber governance and technology, then we go into these legal foundations in our modern cyber law and policy. And that's really focusing on the Constitution, how our Bill of Rights works when we think about things like the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and the Fourth Amendment, our right to privacy. And then we talk about the U.S. statutory framework of law, and that would include things like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and our electronic surveillance scheme. Then we, you know, we talk about things like torts and how do torts work in cyber law, getting people to think about things, you know, in the workplace that happen online that are considerations that folks need to make. And then we really, where really the final module is where we get into cyber operations, and that's sort of the meat of this from the standpoint of, you know, what we consider today an offensive operations and defensive operations. And we did it through sort of a cyber threat response framework where we looked at operations by and against private actors, and so how our domestic law comes into play and that intersection, again, with international law and international norms in cyber operations. And we really went through then the international right to conduct cyber operations. And one thing we did to keep students engaged is use real, you know, real caseword examples. So we talked about Estonia. We talked about different, you know, situations that folks can look at and read about in real news, you know, articles and think, okay, here's how this played out. Here's how the law works. And here's how we intersect that technology, domestic law, and national security.
And by the way, the National Initiative for Cyber Education, part of NIST, NICE, they call it, that was also involved too, wasn't it?
Yes. But to be clear, we worked directly with the NSA on this.
Sure.
We did not interact with NIST. You know, it was the NSA that issued the calls for proposals and the NSA that directly funded this. So, yes, it's part of that broader operations, and so are all of the other courses that are available. But really, we're seeing a concerted effort on the part of the federal government in a very positive way to get the U.S., you know, workforce up to speed on cyber knowledge, right? Both technology, security, and law. And that, you know, sort of we all hear the more you know, but recognizing that the better we have an educated workforce, the better we are going to be more resilient in our democracy and being aware of what we, you know, how we can be manipulated by malicious actors. And that's a big part of the goal of the course.
Technology changes, the law changes, policy changes, they all sort of drive one another in many ways. How do you keep this up to date in the future?
Yeah, so one thing is we've definitely, you know, on the PowerPoints and things like that, we really tried to bring it from the basic platform of technology and law up to current conditions, you know, and current situations and current technology. But we know, right, a year from now it'll be out of date as we continue to advance with artificial intelligence and machine learning. And so we don't have a built-in mechanism yet with NSA, but it's clear that these initiatives are ongoing on the part of the federal government, right? So we don't have a specific plan or proposal for this particular course, but that is, you know, in a broader way, they continue to do this.
And has anyone taken the course so far that it's been up online, I guess, a month or so now? And do you know who they are?
Right. So it's interesting. In terms of, we are not getting reports from Clark Center about academics that are downloading the course. We do know that the course is getting traction and hits and views. And so what's interesting is we're seeing both like private sector, private industry sources. I, you know, was in a meeting in D.C. last week with Privacy Law Salon, and someone from PwC said, hey, we've downloaded that, and all of our, a lot of our staff are going through the course materials. So I'm hearing both individuals and private sector companies are accessing and using it, but as well, you know, the goal is really that, you know, educational institutions across the country, which sometimes guard their curriculum development, right? They want to make money off of it. The goal is hopefully folks across universities in the U.S. are taking pieces of this and using it to, you know, develop and enhance their own curriculum offerings.
Anne Toomey McKenna is a law professor at Penn State University. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
We'll post this interview along with a link to more about the course at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive at Apple Podcasts or Podcast One. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligence Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
From idea to battlefield, innovation is at the heart of mission success. At Leidos, we're helping customers accelerate readiness, resilience, and strategic modernization. Leidos is number one on the Washington Technology Top 100, bringing unrivaled talent to bear through our software factories and providing proven autonomy capabilities, agile and SecDevOps, and advanced AI/ML that allows you to see the full picture faster. At Leidos, we're developing practical answers for a complicated world. Visit leidos.com/defense to learn how.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home. So take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors. And install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by UnitedHealthcare and AARP Foundation.